Welcome. We begin the 14th chapter in the series on Essays on the Gita. This chapter is titled The Principle of Divine Works. It came to the public on the 15th of September, 1917. In that issue, The Life Divine was the lead article, of course, and the chapter title there was From the Undivine to the Divine, and following Essays on the Gita, the piece was Synthesis of Yoga, and the chapter title was Vijnana, or Gnosis. Sri Aurobindo has been setting for us the stage on the subject of Karma Yoga. It is not a yoga simply of activity. It is not a yoga simply of ritual or of sacrifice. Sacrifice is an inadequate English term for what is yajna in Sanskrit. For the Gita, which as we find it in the historical context of India, was a champion for reconstituting the spiritual life of the country in the facts of life as we meet them, as we see them, as we join them. This was not a flight that the Gita saw would be productive in leaving the world. What in thunderation? Who knows what triggers these things? I'll tell you what. We will ensure that this cannot happen again. Give me a moment. I will absent myself and return with this banished to the other side of the center. And if I may make light for a moment, that little musical interlude was from a group named Disingenuous. I have no idea who they are. If one of you sent me this blessing, teasing. Back to the context. The Gita stands in bold relief to the popular movements away from involvement in life in these early centuries BCE. The Gita calls us to use even our active life, the situation in which we find ourselves, as being appointed to us, not thrust upon us, offered to us in a way that we can turn it around and make it an offering to the divine. That the divine is not some being who is simply extra cosmic, lives outside the world as vast self or as a person above and beyond, but who is seated in the heart of all creatures here, who is omnipresent. And so if we do work in the right way, attuning our consciousness such that we do it not for our own gratification, but simply as a work to be offered through nature back to the source of all, then we invite the greatest felicity into the world and we get a portion of that too. So, The idea now is, how do we do it? What is essential for having this spiritual approach to an active life? How do we affirm the world in a way that is meaningful? How do we bring the divine into our actual existence? So Sri Aurobindo begins this essay with this sentence. This, then, is the sense of the Gita's doctrine of sacrifice. Its full significance depends on the idea of the Purushottama, which as yet is not developed. We find it set forth clearly only much later in the 18 chapters, and therefore we have had to anticipate at whatever cost of infidelity to the progressive method of the Gita's exposition, that central teaching. So his point is that work is not mere work. It's not mere activity. Work is itself an offering. The Gita's progressive method is, of course, to begin with knowledge, to proceed to works, and to culminate in love. And the Gita unrolls all of this in phase after phase over 18 chapters. Sri Aurobindo, of course, to make sense of it to us, has to talk about it all at once. And that's a good lesson for us, too, because we can't really grasp the Gita going through it one shloka at a time. We don't get the whole picture. You've got to have the whole 18 chapters inside you to understand what the context is for the second chapter, for the fourth chapter, etc., etc. You have to be able to see the comprehensive picture, which is the Gita's view of God, universe, and self. Purushottama, of course, means supreme, ultimate person. So this is the theistic teaching. This is not an abstract, sheer being who is the object of our pursuit, but the divine, an all-containing, all-subsuming, all-transcending divine. At present, the teacher simply gives a hint, merely adumbrates this supreme presence of the Purushottama and his relation to the immobile self, in whom it is our first business, our pressing spiritual need, to find our poise of perfect peace and equality by attainment to the Brahmic condition. So yes, there is a truth in that which the sannyasis seek, the absolute beyond space and time. We have somehow to get free of the ego and our attachment to things, gratification of desires, sense that we are something separate from others. So we have to transcend. We have to get to this akshara Brahman first. But we have to go farther. He speaks, as yet, not at all in set terms of the Purushottama, but of himself. I, Krishna, Narayana, the avatar, the God in man, who is also the Lord in the universe incarnated in the figure of the divine charioteer of Kurukshetra. And this next is a quote from chapter 4, shloka 35. In the self, then in me, is the formula he gives, implying that the transcendence of the individual personality by seeing it as a becoming in the impersonal self-existent being is simply a means of arriving at that great secret impersonal personality, which is thus silent, calm, and uplifted above nature in the impersonal being, but also present and active in nature, in all these million becomings. So, both Akshara Brahman, akshara purusha and kshara purusha. Losing our lower individual personality in the impersonal, we arrive finally at union with the Supreme Personality, which is not separate and individual, but yet assumes all individualities. Transcending the lower nature of the three gunas and seating the soul in the immobile purusha beyond the three gunas, we can ascend finally into the higher nature of the infinite Godhead, which is not bound by the three gunas even when it acts through nature. Reaching the inner actionlessness of the silent purusha, naishkarmya, and leaving prakriti to do her works, we can attain supremely beyond to the status of the divine mastery, which is able to do all works and yet be bound by none. The idea of the Purushottama, seen here as the incarnate Narayana, Krishna, is therefore the key. Without it, the withdrawal from the lower nature to the Brahmic condition leads necessarily to inaction of the liberated man, his indifference to the works of the world. With it, the same withdrawal becomes a step by which the works of the world are taken up in the spirit, with the nature, and in the freedom of the divine. See the silent Brahman as the goal, and the world with all its activities has to be forsaken. See God, the divine, the Purushottama, as the goal, superior to action, yet its inner spiritual cause and object and original will, and the world with all its activities is conquered and possessed in a divine transcendence of the world. It can become, instead of a prison house, an opulent kingdom, Rajyam Samriddham, 1133, which we have conquered for the spiritual life by slaying the limitation of the tyrant ego and overcoming the bondage of our jailer desires and breaking the prison of our individualistic possession and enjoyment. The liberated universalized soul becomes Swarat, Samrat, self-ruler and emperor. The freedom into the Akshara Brahman is necessary, but without the liberation, the fusion of our being into Purushottama, we have not solved the cosmic mystery. The works of sacrifice are thus vindicated as a means of liberation and absolute spiritual perfection. Sansiddhi. And so for the next page or so, we'll be traversing chapter 3, shlokas 20 through 26. So Janaka and other great karma yogins of the mighty ancient yoga attained to perfection by equal and desireless works done as a sacrifice, without the least egoistic aim or attachment. Karma naiva hi sansidham astita janakai dayaha. So too, and with the same desirelessness, after liberation and perfection, works can and have to be continued by us in a large divine spirit, with a calm high nature of a spiritual royalty. Thou shouldst do works regarding also the holding together of the peoples, lokasangraham evapi sampashyam kartum arhasi, Whatsoever the best doeth, that the lower kind of man puts into practice. The standard he creates, the people follows. O son of Pritha, I have no work that I need to do in all the three worlds. I have nothing that I have not gained and have yet to gain, and I abide verily in the paths of action. Varta eva cha karmani, eva implying, I abide in it and do not leave it as the sannyasi thinks himself bound to abandon works. For if I did not abide sleeplessly in the paths of action, men follow in every way my path. These peoples would sink to destruction if I did not works, and I should be the creator of confusion and slay these creatures. As those who know not act with attachment to the action, he who knows should act without attachment, having for his motive to hold together the peoples. He should not create a division of their understanding in the ignorant who are attached to their works. He should set them to all actions, doing them himself with knowledge and in yoga. There are few more important passages in the Gita than these seven striking couplets. So holding together the people, loka sangraha. So if we need a motive other than simply the cause of giving everything that we do and feel and think and see to the divine, then it has to be without appointment to ourself, but to hold together the worlds. Loka sangraha means holding together the worlds. Yes, all these people who form humanity, but the peoples of all worlds, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, beyond the kingdom of the gods, our acts help the whole of the cosmos to cohere, not simply the visible, tangible universe in space and time that we meet with our senses, but all the worlds. So you can see we have incarnated here a tremendous responsibility. There is no idle moment. Yes, you have to carry it lightly and you have to keep a sense of humor and you have to see the delight, the rasa in all things and move towards felicity and overcome division and face down the dreadful. We have to meet all of that. But we do it for the divine who is seated in the hearts of all these beings. Even when we serve the world, even when we do it for loka sangraha, really, it is a gift to the Supreme Person, Purushottama. But this idea of loka sangraha, let's come to this now. But let us clearly understand that they must not be interpreted as the modern pragmatic tendency concerned much more with the present affairs of the world than with any high and far-off spiritual possibility seeks to interpret them as no more than a philosophical and religious justification of social service, patriotic, cosmopolitan, and humanitarian effort and attachment to the 100 eager social schemes and dreams which attract the modern intellect. Pause for a moment and look at a bit of intellectual history. The Gita had come to be known in the West by now, the early 20th century. Much had been written about it already. Scholars in the East were also taking it up, and everything was couched in terms that were relevant to the times. The idea dominant in Western philosophic political thought was the perfectibility of the human race, and so everything had a social context. Sri Aurobindo won't have it. He is taking us back to the original meaning, the deeper meaning of what the Gita is seeking here. It is not the rule of a large moral and intellectual altruism which is here announced, but that of a spiritual unity with God and with this world of beings who dwell in him and in whom he dwells. It is not an injunction to subordinate the individual to society and humanity, or immolate egoism on the altar of the human collectivity, but to fulfill the individual in God and to sacrifice the ego on the one true altar of the all-embracing divinity. Yes, already, of course, we had the great arguments going on between Marxism, capitalism, democracy, socialism. All of this was the talk of the day. Sri Aurobindo is vaulting beyond to a reality that awaits us. To fulfill the individual in God and to sacrifice the ego on the one true altar of the all-embracing divinity. The Gita moves on a plane of ideas and experiences higher than those of the modern mind, which is at the stage indeed of a struggle to shake off the coils of egoism, but is still mundane in its outlook and intellectual and moral rather than spiritual in its temperament. Patriotism, cosmopolitanism, service of society, collectivism, humanitarianism, the ideal or religion of humanity are admirable aids towards our escape from our primary condition of individual, family, social, national egoism into a secondary stage in which the individual realizes, as far as it can be done on the intellectual, moral, and emotional level, on that level he cannot do it entirely in the right and perfect way, the way of the integral truth of his being, the oneness of his existence with the existence of other beings. But the thought of the Gita reaches beyond to a tertiary condition of our developing self-consciousness, towards which the secondary is only a partial stage of advance. So that unification of self and the worlds back to the originating divine is the goal of the Gita. That's the tertiary, the third condition. And we welcome developing a non-egoistic approach to the world, but it too is limited and will have, shall we say, flaccid results. The Indian social tendency has been to subordinate the individual to the claims of society. But Indian religious thought and spiritual seeking have been always loftily individualistic in their aims. An Indian system of thought, like the Gita's, cannot possibly fail to put first the development of the individual, the highest need of the individual, his claim to discover and exercise his largest spiritual freedom, greatness, splendor, royalty, his aim to develop into the illumined seer and king in the spiritual sense of seerdom and kingship, which was the first great charter of the ideal humanity promulgated by the ancient Vedic sages. This would later, in a few hundred years, become part of the tantric imprint also on India. In a sense, pushing back against the cancellation of the world and its values by Buddhism and Jainism and Advaita. To continue, to exceed himself was their goal for the individual, not by losing all his personal aims and the aims of an organized human society, but by enlarging, heightening, aggrandizing himself into the consciousness of the Godhead. The rule given here by the Gita is the rule for the master man, the superman, the divinized human being, the best Shrestham, not in the sense of any Nietzschean, any one-sided and lopsided, any Olympian, Apollonian, or Dionysian, any angelic or demoniac supermanhood, but in that of the man whose whole personality has been offered up into the being, nature, and consciousness of the one transcendent and universal divinity, and by loss of the smaller self, has found its greater self, has been divinized. So, this is interesting that the teaching of the Gita is directed by Krishna to Arjuna, a great prince, a ruler, and in this we see that this ruler must take on the characteristics of the divine and be on earth what the divine is. Impersonal, but also deeply personal. Individual, but vast. We see an identity of kingship with the divine. There should be a modeling of the human vehicle to fit and reflect the divine. We found this in the Veda, where Indra massages his identity into his devotee, Kutsa. We see it here. We see it in the idea of Nara and Narayana. We see this implied instruction to humanity, starting with those who have their service from a sort of pinnacle of humanhood. They have to be able to act without ego. They must be vehicles through which the divine will operates. So their first goal must be step beyond self-definition, self-gratification, and serve. All acts must be acts of offering. All delights belong essentially to that. To exalt oneself out of the lower imperfect prakriti. Trigunya Maya, into unity with the divine being, consciousness, and nature, Madbhavam Agata, is the object of the yoga. That's 4:10. And we have a footnote. Sayujya, Salokya, and Sadrishya, or Sadharmya. Sadharmya is becoming of one law of being and action with the divine. Sayujya, union, salokya, being in one world, one place, one space, sharing habitation. Sadrisha, having the same appearance or likeness, can also suggest seeing in the same way. Sadharmya, obviously, that is being of the same law, sharing that truth of active being. And we find these terms occurring in the Mahabharata itself, even though they don't appear here in the Gita, but they do occur in the Mahabharata, and I believe they do, and in the Bhagavata Purana. But when this object is fulfilled, when the man is in the Brahmic status and sees no longer with the false egoistic vision himself and the world, but sees all beings in the self, in God, and the self in all beings, God in all beings, what shall be the action, since action there still is, which results from that seeing, and what shall be the cosmic or individual motive of all his works? This is the great question. By the way, this arises in the language of the Gita in chapter 6, 29, also in 10:20 and 13:31, if you care to note. It is the question of Arjuna. There's a footnote. Let me see if my eyes can see this. Kim prabhasheta, kim asita vrajetam kim. It's a little small. That's 254. It is the question of Arjuna. And basically, it's saying, how does he sit? How does he stand? How does he move, this divine one? It is the question of Arjuna, but answered from a standpoint other than that from which Arjuna had put it. Arjuna has asked it from an external eye. How can I tell who this divine person is? Does he stand nobly? What does he look like? What sort of hairstyle does he have? But Sri Aurobindo points out that the Gita's answer all points to the inner. How do you see the inner without developing an inner consciousness? You must practice yoga. There is no escape. So I start again. It is the question of Arjuna, but answered from a standpoint other than that from which Arjuna had put it. The motive cannot be personal desire on the intellectual, moral, emotional level, for that has been abandoned. Even the moral motive has been abandoned, since the liberated man has passed beyond the lower distinction of sin and virtue, lives in a glorified purity beyond good and evil. It cannot be the spiritual call to his perfect self-development by means of disinterested works. For the call has been answered. The development is perfect and fulfilled. His motive of action can only be the holding together of the peoples. Chikirshur Loka Sangraham 3:25. This great march of the peoples towards a far-off divine ideal has to be held together, prevented from falling into the bewilderment, confusion, and utter discord of the understanding, which would lead to dissolution and destruction, and to which the world moving forward in the night or dark twilight of ignorance would be too easily prone if it were not held together, conducted, kept to the great lines of its discipline by the illumination, by the strength, by the rule and example, by the visible standard and the invisible influence of its best. So, do we need even to point out that this itself is the hour of God for us? This is our Kurukshetra, this moment. We must behave, we must lead and step in light towards a greater light. in a means that holds the world together. And if we have to pass beyond all the laws and the moralities to achieve it, all the confusions, the subterfuges, the rank egoism that besets us from every part of the world, then let us do it. It is your deeper fraternity, uniting you all, which alone can save the earth. That fraternity, that oneness, is the soul of the cosmos. You are that. The best Chapter 3:21, the best, the individuals who are in advance of the general line and above the general level of the collectivity, are the natural leaders of mankind. For it is they who can point to the race, both the way they must follow and the standard or ideal they have to keep to or to attain. But the divinized man is the best in no ordinary sense of the word. And his influence, his example, must have a power which that of no ordinarily superior man can exercise. What example then shall he give? What rule or standard shall he uphold? We'll put our bookmark there and turn to the chapter soon for completion. I think it's appropriate to mention, isn't it, that we're about a week away from the 150th birthday of Sri Aurobindo. And some of you will know that celebrations will be going on all around the world marking this. You, wherever you are, the center of your own ashram in your own home, will be noting the day with significance. If you're able to pull together with people and share a platform, share some benches, share a meditating circle here and there, well and good. The Sri Aurobindo Association in America has sent out a general invitation inviting people to attend some appointed workshops all the way from Thursday to Sunday. I'm sure you've received those invitations. Here in Pensacola, we will also be celebrating on the 15th itself, and I'll send you a note if you want to come in and be with us in a Zoom room, or if you have great courage and want to traverse the country and sit with us in person, you're welcome to come. We have room for any pilgrim who's willing to live like a pilgrim for a few days. So, happy birthday to you in advance. And so if we take up Essays in the Gita next Sunday, we'll also say a few words about Sri Aurobindo. It may be that we spend the whole time talking about Sri Aurobindo, because it will already be the 15th of August in India when we gather for our Sunday evening meeting. So, it will be Sri Aurobindo's birth anniversary. So this is a bit of savatry that I'll read now. From Book 10, The Book of the Double Twilight, I know. Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real. I think we're going to start on page 661. The Mighty Mother sits in lucent calm and holds the Eternal Child upon her knees, attending the day when he shall speak to fate. There is the image of our future's hope. There is the sun for which all darkness waits. There is the imperishable harmony. The world's contradictions climb to her and are one. There is the truth of which the world's truths are shreds, the light of which the world's ignorance is the shade, till truth draws back the shade that it has cast, the love our hearts call down to heal all strife, the bliss for which the world's derelict sorrows yearn. Thence comes the glory sometimes seen on earth, the visits of Godhead to the human soul, the beauty and the dream on nature's face. There, the perfection born from eternity calls to it the perfection born in time, the truth of God surprising human life, the image of God overtaking finite shapes. There, in a world of everlasting light, in the realms of the immortal supermind, truth, who hides here her head in mystery, her riddle deemed by reason impossible in the stark structure of material form, unenigma lives, unmasked her face, and there is nature and the common law of things. There, in a body made of spirit stuff, the hearthstone of the ever-living fire, action translates the movements of the soul, thought steps infallible and absolute, and life is a continual worship's rite, a sacrifice of rapture to the One. A cosmic vision, a spiritual sense, feels all the infinite lodged in finite form, and seen through a quivering ecstasy of light, discovers the bright face of the bodiless, in the truth of a moment, in the moment's soul, can sip the honey wine of eternity. A spirit who is no one and innumerable, the one mystic infinite person of his world, multiplies his myriad personality, on all his bodies seals his divinity's stamp, and sits in each immortal and unique. The immobile stands behind each daily act, a background of the movement and the scene, upholding creation on its might and calm, and change on the immutable's deathless poise. The timeless looks out from the traveling hours. The ineffable puts on a robe of speech where all its words are woven like magic threads, moving with beauty, inspiring with their gleam, and every thought takes up its destined place, recorded in the memory of the world. The truth supreme, vast and impersonal, fits faultlessly the hour and circumstance, its substance a pure gold, ever the same, but shaped into vessels for the spirit's use. Its gold becomes the wine jar and the vase. All there is a supreme epiphany. The all-wonderful makes a marvel of each event. The all-beautiful is a miracle in each shape. The all-blissful smites with rapture the heart's throbs. A pure celestial joy is the use of sense. Each being there is a member of the self, a portion of the million-thoughted all, a claimant to the timeless unity, the many's sweetness, the joy of difference, edged with the intimacy of the One. So, Namaste, Jai Ma.